17 seconds and counting. Guidance internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2. All engines running.
Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are willing to postpone, and one we intend to win.
Okay, engine stop. ATA at a descent. Air control mode, auto descent, engine command override off. Engine arm on. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This is Cosmic Perspective Radio. I'm your host, Andy Paneros. Today on Cosmic Perspective Radio is part two of Dr. Jim Green's very cool discussions at an open forum with the media during the New Horizons Pluto flyby event at Applied Physics Lab. First, Dr. Green discusses what NASA is doing to prevent a large asteroid from impacting the Earth. There are thousands of impact craters on the Earth. Most of them have been worn away or covered through weathering and erosion. And most of them occurred long before the Earth had any type of atmosphere. But there is evidence that a comet impact may have caused the dinosaurs to become extinct. And as we know from a recent breaking up and impact of a meteor over Russia in 2013, the reality is that a large object will eventually impact the Earth.
When I was head of planetary science, starting in 2006, we were spending $4.5 million on it. We're now up to 50. We put a program in place that leverages every asset that's capable to providing significant detection of NEOs available on this Earth that we can get our hands on. And we've done really pretty good. So the first thing we wanted to do over that last, you know, decade or two, actually, really, you know, Congress really challenged us in 98 is where the bill really came out and said, you need to be finding the really big ones. We believe we pretty well found 99% of the 1 kilometer and greater asteroids. So those are the ones that would either do incredibly significant damage or be a planet killer, you know, killing a significant number of species like we've seen in some of the other fossil records. And when you look at those and you map them out and you see where they go, because we have to monitor them all the time. Once we start this program, we have to continue this program because these near-Earth objects come actually from the asteroid belt, and it's because gravitational interactions with Jupiter throws them inward or throws them outward. And the ones they throw out, we don't care about, but the ones they throw in, we got to know about. And so then they become near-Earth objects, and they become potentially hazardous ones. So we've really done an enormous amount of work in that to know that we shouldn't be alarmed, at least for the really big ones, over the next 100 to 200 years. But that's the best we can extrapolate out. There is one that we're going to with a launch in September of next year. The mission is called OSIRIS-REx, and it's going to a huge asteroid, which is only 500 meters, but that's still pretty hefty, called Bennu. And Bennu is a carbonaceous chondrite. It's one that we feel is probably chock full of potentially some building blocks of life. It's those kind of asteroids that hit the Earth early on that may have provided this crust that we live on, the material that ends up in water that starts life, that, you know, that may have started the chain. So we just need to know more about it. But that darn thing is a potentially hazardous one. You know, in just a couple hundred years, it comes really close to Earth. And in fact, Earth is in their air ellipse. So we need to monitor it. We need to know about it. We need to bring back some samples and understand the science. But we need to know potentially if it becomes hazardous, what we're going to do about it. And that's all about learning its characteristics. Everything from its density to its structure to how fast it spins to its composition. And that will inform us on how to mitigate it. So I think we're doing really pretty good. Could we do better? Yes. We really are surveying the sky, and it just takes time. So let me give you an analogy. Because we use ground-based telescopes. How many have driven the Beltway around Washington? Okay. So as you're driving around on the Beltway, and you're looking, you can see cars. So this is, pretend that's the Earth's orbit, and you're the Earth. So you see cars ahead of you to the next exit, and you see cars behind you in your rearview mirror to the last exit. But you're not seeing the cars on the other side of the Beltway. And so when do you see those? Well, you'll only see those if they are moving either slightly slower or slightly faster than you are. Then you will eventually catch up to you, and you'll pass them, or they will pass you, and then therefore you'll see them. Does that take a long time? Yeah, that's what takes a long time. It takes a long time to observe everything in our environment that's potentially hazardous, because in their orbits, they're only moving slightly slower or faster than we are. That, and then they're potentially hazardous because they could collide with the Earth. We could attract them and bring them in, and then we'd have that problem. So this is why we need our ground-based assets to continually look for them. And even though each and every night we might find a bunch, we're not going to find all of them because it's just going to take a long time to do. And so the more assets we bring on, the more sky we can see, the more we can find, and then the longer we need to do that, we'll find them all. So there's a couple ways to do better. One would be a survey mission, you know, get a mission up that actually gets into space and spends nothing but all its time looking for them. And we've been talking about that. It's not on the books yet. But there is interest, it's potentially a national resource. It's potentially, you know, has a lot of utility. But it also has a lot of science. You know, these bodies are different types because their origin is actually collisions of other objects in the asteroid belt that were accumulated billions of years ago, and we want to know their parent objects. We want to know, okay, this one's like this one, this one, this one, this one, because they were all together at one time over there. And that's quite a detective story. And so if they were there, how did they get the material they have? What part of the collapsing cloud was it? What was in it? You know, how is it differentiated? And all that stuff, you know, that scientists want to know that really explain the detailed structure of it. But we're doing pretty good in that area. We're not ignoring it. Oh, I could be here all day. I just love talking about what we do. It's so exciting. It really is.
What is the possibility of NASA sharing information with private companies that plan to send missions to nearby asteroids?
We're looking for organizations that we could partner with, for which we're starting that process by having information available that they can use. It's free and open to the public to make decisions on what they would do next. At that phase, or at that step, when they actually say, these are the things that we want to do, then I'm sure we'll want to start a dialogue in terms of how are they doing it, what do they do, how can we help, and we'd get more involved at that stage. It's a business we're always going to have to be in. It's an occupational hazard to keep the Earth safe, is to constantly keep a monitoring capability looking out for near-Earth objects. So any information about near-Earth objects that we can use for characterization and understanding that would potentially go towards saving this Earth
or even part of our population through impacts, we're going to want to do that.
After New Horizons, what are NASA's future plans for the exploration of Pluto?
So orbiting Pluto would be the next step, okay? That would have to be discussed and debated in the next planetary decadal. And that'll be predicated on what we learn from that mission and what we learn in general about Kuiper Belt objects to determine if that's worthy a goal to do. It's going to probably also require some technology development for us to be able to pull that off. And so, but that's what we do. We identify those difficult things to do, those really tough questions we want to answer, and then look at what kind of technologies we have to develop to implement those. So that would be part and parcel of that kind of mission. So indeed, that's where we are with Pluto, is just the flyby. If you look at the moon, we have flew by it, we've orbited it, we've landed, we've roved, the Russians have roved, and we've returned samples. Where are we with Mars? Well, with Mars, we flew by it, we've orbited it, we've landed, we've roved, and of course, the 2020 mission is our first step towards creating cores that of a specific geological interest and even astrobiological interest for later return. So Mars now is moving into that direction of having a complete set of information and a body well worthy of doing that.
With plans for an orbiter being the next step for the exploration of Pluto, I had to ask the question of the possibility of using a spacecraft with ion propulsion for the mission.
Yeah, it's a good question. Ion propulsion is really a great new technology. We use it quite effectively for Dawn, and we're also developing a massive ion propulsion to haul cargo back and forth to Mars for human exploration. But that's predicated on obtaining a significant amount of power, and we do that right now with large solar panels. That would be unpractical at Pluto. So we would have to look for a unique advancement in nuclear propulsion technology to do anything like using ion propulsion at Pluto. But I love the idea if we can pull that off.
Next, Dr. Jim Green tells us about one of his goals as director of planetary science.
So I've told everybody in the planetary science, I plan to be the head, plan to be the director of planetary science at NASA when we find life beyond Earth. That's my goal. Now, that tells them they better get busy. We got a lot of work to do. Actually, that's shocked. You know, I was at an executive committee meeting of the Astrobiology Institute, which we fund, and I told them that, and they were shocked. I'm like, well, you guys shocked? You're the astrobiologist. Go find it. You know, that will be another unbelievable moment, because if we can find life beyond Earth, that tells us immediately life is everywhere. And when you think about it, what we find when we bring back material from comets and we see amino acids, and we make measurements all throughout the solar system, the air we breathe is mostly nitrogen. Mostly nitrogen. Pluto is mostly nitrogen, its atmosphere. 10 to 1, by 10 to 1, okay? Titan, a moon around Saturn, is mostly nitrogen. You know, so inner solar system, middle solar system at Saturn, and out in the Kuiper Belt. You know, there are some fundamental materials that came in our collapsing cloud, and they're indigenous to us. But our collapsing cloud also generated another several hundred stars. And when you do the dynamics of those stars forming and how they interact gravitationally, and the Kuiper Belt objects that are out in our system that we know about that are susceptible of being formed in around one of the stars and being pulled out and end up around another star, and then knowing the comets live out there too. A lot of the comets that we get live out in the Kuiper Belt. You know, that's where they come out and then before they come in.
And we see amino acids in that stuff. You know, that's a building block of life. That means this whole nebula that generated all the stars in our local group did nothing but share spit when they were generated. Okay? What we see in this solar system is in every one of the solar systems in the local cloud that we're in. And so if we find life here, it's got to be in every one of those. Well, so how unique is this cloud? It's not. We see all sorts of different materials, you know, compounds, carbon compounds, organic chemistry all over the place in clouds all around us. And so if we find life beyond Earth, it's everywhere. No doubt about it.
Even in our own backyard, the solar system, we found hydrocarbons, the building blocks of life, moons on planets with underlying saltwater oceans and mountains and lakes of liquid ethane and methane. Will we find life in our own solar system? The only way for us to have an opportunity to answer this question is to continue to explore. Thanks for listening to part two of Dr. Jim Green's discussions at the New Horizons Pluto Flyby event. Cosmic Perspective Radio is an Andy Panaros production.